These white people are the Redneck Revolt. Now, they aren't a bunch of rednecks revolting against equality like I first thought. They're actually rednecks revolting against the rednecks who are revolting against equality. I'll explain.
Hello, and welcome to The Last Laugh. My name's Matt Wilstein, and I'm a senior writer at The Daily Beast. This week on the show, a comedian I've had the pleasure of interviewing a bunch of times in the past and was super excited to get in our LA studio, W. Kamau Bell. Kamau came down here from Berkeley to talk about, among other things, the fourth season of his show, United Shades of America, which is currently airing on CNN. He told me what it's like to travel to all corners of the U.S. with Trump as president and shared his thoughts about the continued lack of diversity in late-night TV 6 years after his previous show, Totally Biased, was canceled. I can't wait to share our lively conversation with you, so let's get right to it. This is The Last Laugh with today's guest, W. Kamau Bell. Kamau, thank you for making the trip down from the Bay Area.
Well, thank you for letting me bully you into putting me on your
podcast. Yeah, I think you're probably the first and only comic to reach out to me directly on Twitter requesting to be a guest, so thank you for that.
Really? That makes me feel like people aren't doing their jobs.
Yeah, me too.
Comics not wanting attention? Comics not wanting to talk on podcasts? Isn't that what we do?
Yeah. So yeah, United Shades of America is back on CNN for season four.
Season four.
I can't really believe it's season four already. Can you?
I mean, I can feel every episode in my bones, so I do believe it's season four. But I do understand that people. It seems like it's not season four because it's only 8 episodes a season, and also it feels like it's gone for a long time when it's gone. So people have no real sense of how long it's been. So people are like, "You're fine. Where have you been?" Well, it's been exactly a year since I was on last time. But and also the rate of the news is that it feels like if you don't hear from somebody for 2 months, you feel like it's been like 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, when we first talked about this show, I think right around when it was launching in 2016, that was obviously a lot has changed since then.
Yep.
How has doing the show changed in that time, and specifically, you know, after in this Trump existence that we're all in?
Yeah, are all of us in it? Are all of us,
whether we like it or not?
Yeah, we're experiencing it. So you know, I always said, like, well, after we got to the second season, after Trump was elected, I always said I felt like the first season was like the mixtape, and the second season was like the album. Mm, you know,
yeah.
And so I think that we've just gotten it. It feels like the show is very clear, and also I hear from people all the time about what they expect from the show or what they get from the show. So a lot of the show, especially this season, is based on like feedback from random people in airports, things that they liked about the show or things that that the show means to them. I was talking to the people at CNN about it. I was like, there's three versions of the show. There's the version of there's the thing I think the show is. There's the thing that CNN thinks the show is, and then there's this audience that people at airports who tell me what they think it is. So I think for this season, I was really listening to the audience because I get a lot of direct feedback.
Can you break down the difference between what you think it is and what CNN thinks it is?
I mean, I think, yes, without getting fired or canceled. No, I mean, I really feel like, how would I put, like, I think you could send us to anywhere on the planet and just let us film, and we're gonna find a big story there. Mm-hmm. I think every place has its big story. I don't really think that we have to have, you know, I don't really think that. Sometimes there's a sort of a focus, like CNN wants to sort of know exactly what every episode's going to be about, and I'm of the belief that like we can get there and we'll figure it out, you know, and that the show can have a broader mission than just like we're hitting one issue a week or one issue an episode. So sometimes I'm like, well, just send us to New Orleans.
That sounds fun.
And they're like, no. Like, but we'll talk about Katrina. We'll talk about some things. But I think they want the show to be more narrowly focused, which is fine because I think it's good to have limits. You know, if you have no limits, then you have no function or form sometimes. So for me, and then the audience is like, you need to come do a show about my neighborhood because shit has hit the fan in my neighborhood. Like, they think it's like the news, kind of.
Yeah.
You know? Like, they really think it's like, you know, or you need to do a show about this particular high school. You know what I mean? Like, and it doesn't really work that way. Like, we may do or you need to do a show about, you know, really specific things that are like, we're not exactly like going to just cover like just one hyper-focused issue. You're always going to have a big picture look at things. So from people, they think it's the news, basically.
Has there been someone that's come up to you in an airport and said, do this, and then you did?
Well, on Twitter, last season, we had the episode about the Sikh community, or the Sikh religion, And that was based on a tweet that somebody sent to me. That's mm-hmm. why I learned to send tweets to you. Because he yeah, was yeah. like, I think he sent it to a man named Harpreet Singh. I think it was during an episode about Muslims. He's like, that's a great episode. You should do one about the Sikh religion. I was like, okay. So that literally happened that way. And then a lot of times, you know, I'm trying to think in airports. Has there been anybody in it? No, mostly in airports I hear about what people think, like how the show impacts their lives. I hear a lot of families watch it together. I hear a lot about which episodes were their favorites. I hear the words Ku Klux Klan a lot, which mm-hmm. is like...
Well, that was your first ever episode.
That was
episode,
the first.
Right?
I'm still yeah. hearing about that episode. Yeah. But yeah, like and about how... And then I hear a lot of like, you keep doing it. You got to keep it up. Like people, there's this sense for the people who like it that it's doing something that no other show is doing. So, you know, not that that's true, but that's how I feel. That's the message I get.
And then on the flip side, there's a moment in the new season where someone screams at CNN sucks and fuck CNN at you on the street. I yeah. believe, is that in Seattle? Or,
that's in Seattle. It's in downtown. Yeah, Seattle. It's just funny. That's in Seattle. It's not in yeah. wherever you would think it'd be in America. Yeah. It's in Seattle. Yeah.
And why did you decide to keep that in the episode?
I mean, I'm a big fan of like not believing in the fourth wall. So mm-hmm. I'm always trying to put more of the things that are sort of like about the show or about the filming of the show or also to show that it's a like I like the show when it's more rough and ragged. And so for me, like, and also as a comedian, any spontaneous moments or comedy are like my mm-hmm. favorite thing. So to me it was hilarious that guy in the middle of us filming knew who I was, knew what we were doing. And then the fact that it was funny, he was like, fuck CNN, as he kept walking away.
Yeah.
And so I was like, okay, this guy's not really about that life. So I can keep talking. Like, I can keep sort of screaming, okay, thank you, sir. Like, it was really, like, nice sweater. Like, it was just, to me, I think the show, to me, the version of the show that I do, like, because, you know, Lisa Ling has a show on CNN. There are other shows on CNN. I have to lean into the parts that I feel like are best for me. Otherwise, they all start to look the same. Like, Lisa Ling's probably not going to leave the fuck CNN moment in the show.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's happened at some point. But for me, I'm like, whenever things happen that weren't to the plan, I get excited. So, yeah, I think... And also, I think it's important for me to know that I'm a real person, so I'm not just some sort of person on TV talking. Like, I'm a real person, and that's the moment of, like, I'm a real person. This guy's yelling at me because he does... The thing that you're watching right now, he hates.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny to see that happen to you because, I mean, we see, you know, people like, you know, Jim Acosta and some yeah. of these other, you know, hard news people. We know they're getting harassed like yeah. this all the time yeah. at the events, but you kind of wouldn't think it would be happening to you because what you're doing is so different from what they're doing.
Yeah, they're responding to the brand, not necessarily. Yeah. And also, I mean, we cut those moments out. Like, that's, we sometimes, like, I think there was another one in a different episode that was fuck CNN, and CNN was like basically like, or not honestly, but there was sort of the sense of like, you only have one of those.
You're like, every like, episode can't have fuck yeah, CNN.
But it just so happened that we were in Philly and somebody said, like, yeah. this one was actually funnier, I think, because this woman came to, she was really upset about what we were talking about, and she wasn't in the interview, but it was in the episode in Philly about toxic environments, about lead poisoning. Mm-hmm. And she was like, very much agree with the fact that we needed to be talking about lead poisoning. You guys didn't even have the whole story. Like, I was talking to one guy, and she was just like in her house and came outside and started yelling at us, mm-hmm. but in agreement. You're right. That's true. We need to do. And she's like, who are you with? And I was like, and I knew the way she yeah. said it, like, this isn't going to be good. It's like CNN. She's like, oh. And I was like, but which I like that more, but we picked our fuck CNN moment.
Yeah. So what have you learned over these four seasons of shooting the show in terms of talking to strangers, especially people you don't agree with, because that's a lot of what you do on mm-hmm. the show. And it's something that most people, I think, are not doing in their own lives, is going out and seeking out people who they disagree with and having conversations with them. So what have you learned about, you know, yourself and how to do that?
Despite what maybe my wife would think, I'm a really good listener. I'm a really good, like, I don't have to agree to you to listen to you, because mm-hmm. I think a lot of times it's important, especially when you disagree with somebody, to be quiet and let them get all their stuff out, because people are so ready to be interrupted when they know they're saying something you don't agree with. They're preparing to be interrupted. And if you interrupt them, then you sort of, it very quickly derails the conversation into a battle of who can talk louder or faster. Mm-hmm. I mean, you see it all the time on TV. And so for me, because United Shades, you know, I have the luxury of time that you don't have in a lot of TV shows, I can let you go for a half hour if you need to get it all out. And then at the end of that half hour, I'll be like, okay, can I say something? And like, I'm sort of like, it, like making sure, did you get it all out? Because, mm-hmm. and I think it sort of puts people, it sort of makes people more comfortable. And it also makes a better conversation, like not trying to get my so usually when people are talking, in the middle of them talking, I'll be like, okay, I need to remember that point, I can't remember that, like I'll sort of try to in my head catalog the things I want to talk back about. and then at the end of it, go back in. But I think people get so quick to, like, you know, pretend like it's high school debate, even though they're not really even following the rules of high school debate, because you can't interrupt in high school debate. But they mm-hmm. want to pretend like it's a, like it's we see it modeled on TV all the time, like people just sort of yammering at each other.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, you know, obviously the show started at the very beginning with that KKK episode, and that was this kind of putting yourself in this dangerous situation in a lot of ways, like mm-hmm. or what could have been a dangerous situation. Are there moments like that in the new season that you felt? Uncomfortable in that same way?
Yeah, I mean, the episode you're talking about in Seattle, Tacoma, the whole lead up of that episode is that we were going to a protest or a rally outside of a Nazi-owned tattoo shop in Tacoma, Washington. And there was just all this talk about the layers of security we needed and how, like, could this come out, need to wear a bulletproof vest? And, like, because these were, like, people who they felt like definitely were armed and might decide to be violent if they feel like that's their last choice. And so there was just all this, I mean, way more than we did with the Klan. Now, the Klan was also the pilot, so maybe we didn't have the budget for bulletproof vests. But there was a lot of talk about, like, a big, you know, from the production company about, meetings about strategy, how to get out, and you're on Kamau, and just grab him, you know, all this mm-hmm. stuff. So that one was, in some sense, was more scary than the Klan, because there was a lot more talking about it before we got in there. So that was the one moment this season. And then you'll see in the episode, it ends up being like this, like families were there, and it was like mm-hmm. a very positive rally at a Nazi-owned tattoo shop.
But you also had some people with guns on your side, on the protest side, yep. There too, which was interesting to see. I mean, what did you think about that that movement? You can tell us what it's called, but the movement that kind of embraces guns from a more left position.
Well, the national movement is the Redneck Revolt. And when you hear that, you think, like, I don't think that sounds good at all. Like, it sounds like rednecks who are going to revolt against me or people that we think should not be revolted against. But it's actually rednecks who are revolting against sort of the idea of rednecks, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, they're people like, I'm from the South, you know, I'm as country as it comes. But I think the ways in which certain people from the South are portraying the South I'm not in support of, as far as, like, people who are, like, you know, literally Nazis or neo-Nazis or the alt-right who are sort of claiming that that's what the South is. And so these are like liberal rednecks, you know. And also, if you grew up in the South, whether you voted Obama or you know, or McCain, it's a gun culture. Mm-hmm. You know, Democrats in the South also grew up around guns. It's not like they only leave those to the Republicans, you know. So it's sort of a way for people who are like, I grew up with guns, I believe in the Second Amendment. And I see how the people who grew up with guns who are racist or homophobic or anti-Semitic, and those people show up at these rallies with their guns, and a lot of us liberals, we don't show up at the rallies with our guns. These people in the Redneck Revolt and also the John Brown Gun Club, specifically in Tacoma and Seattle, are like, we can show up with our guns to stand up to those people, because since we're a white-led organization, our skin will protect us in ways that if you're a black person, you show up to a protest with a gun. That's probably not the best way to go about it, you know.
Yeah, but then there's just more guns on both sides. There is more, but seems dangerous.
There, you know, yes, guns are dangerous. I think we can stipulate that. I think the thing that I learned from those guys is, like, they also believe in, like, you know, as somebody who did spend time in the South, you know, guns are dangerous. I also believe guns are a tool, and I also believe that, like, that I the way they show up to those rallies, they're not showing up to shoot their guns. They're not hoping for violence. They're showing up to say, we're going to show you that we have guns as a way to hopefully prevent violence. And their track record is pretty good, you know. So I'd say that's true. I'm not trying to say that, you know, this is the thing about this episode. It's called Not All White People. Like, so it's like, because I get asked all the time in airports by white people, what do I do? And so we're showing you, like, an assortment of things that white people can do. They're not all get a gun and show up to a Black Lives Matter rally to protect Black Lives Matter activists. That's just one of the things. But there's also other things in that episode to show up you can do. I think it's just the idea of, like, we have to stop pretending like there's only one way to handle this current era of America.
Coming up after the break, W. Kamau Bell on what it's like to be targeted by Fox News host Tucker Carlson. Mother's Day is just around the corner. And it is not easy to find the perfect gift for mom. That's where Skylight comes in. With Mother's Day coming up, there's one gift that thousands of moms have been calling the best gift ever. It's called Skylight, and it's a photo frame you can email photos to, anytime, from anywhere. You can set it up in under 60 seconds. Just plug it in, use the touchscreen to connect to your wireless network, and enjoy. Sending photos to Skylight is effortless. Everyone in your family can just email photos to Mom Skylight, and they'll appear in her home in seconds. It has a black frame, so it looks like a real photo frame that adds a beautiful touch to your home. Skylight Frame has a gorgeous 10-inch touchscreen. You can swipe through photos with your finger, and even tap to thank the person who sent a photo. And it's 100% satisfaction guaranteed. If you don't love your Skylight, they'll offer you a full refund. Now, as a special Mother's Day offer for our listeners, you can get $10 off your purchase of a Skylight Frame when you go to skylightframe.com and enter code LAUGH. That's right, to get $10 off your purchase of a Skylight Frame, just go to skylightframe.com and enter code LAUGH. That's SKYLIGHTFRAME.com. Promo code LAUGH. Another thing I learned about you in this episode that I didn't know before is you're a leader of Antifa.
Yeah, I learned that too from Tucker Carlson.
So you have the clip in the show of him talking about you on his show, which was that flattering, or what'd you think when you saw
fuck
that?
Fuck him.
Kamau Bell is, among other things, a host on CNN. He fronts a show on that channel called United Shades of America. It's run there for 2 seasons now. Bell calls himself a political provocateur, but that doesn't quite capture it. In fact, he is a supporter of Antifa. On Sunday, Bell showed up at the No Hate in the Bay rally and addressed the crowd with a bullhorn. You remember the event. It's the one where mobs in black masks attacked people they thought might have voted for Donald Trump. Bell offered his encouragement.
So when the Nazis leave, as they have left, bye Nazis, bye!
Like, so here's it. So that happened right around the time. There was like all these alt-right marches in Berkeley. And the first time it happened, Berkeley didn't take it that seriously. And so the alt-right was like, oh, they won't come back another time. And they came back another time, and Berkeley didn't take it that seriously. And then the third time, like, every, like, sort of anti-racist activist in the surrounding area, including those in Berkeley, showed up and outnumbered. And I was part of that. That's when I went. As a way to go, not to confront, there were fights that broke out, but most people went to just go, we're going to just put our bodies here to show you that that you're not going to just take over this area. Mm-hmm. It's not okay. So I went there with Pastor Michael McBride, who's also in our megachurch episode.
In the premiere, yeah.
Yeah, and so I went with him, and, you know, and there was Antifa there, and there was school teachers there, and there was, like, you know, there was farmers market people there, and there was, you know, children there, and there's an assortment of people. And the Surge, which is a white privilege organization showing up for racial justice, which is just white people who are anti-racist. And I got on it, me and my wife got on this truck, because they were like, come up here so you can be sort of get out of the crush of the crowd. And I think the one thing I said, like, they gave me a megaphone at one point, and I was like, this is the Berkeley I believe in. We're all here together showing up. And I was like, the Nazis were here, but apparently they left. And I screamed, bye, Nazis, bye. And then Tucker Carlson clipped out the bye, Nazis, bye part, as if that's a bad thing to say.
How dare you say bye to Nazis?
I was just like, well, but somehow he manipulated it too. Like, I was on this Antifa truck, which maybe it was owned by somewhere from Antifa. And then I was somehow a part of Antifa, and Antifa's a hate organization. So therefore, W. Kamau Bell peddles hate. And that's fine and good. The funny thing was, is like, I heard it was going to happen, but what I heard before it aired, Pastor Michael McBride called me and said, they want me to come on Tucker Carlson tonight to talk about this. And I was like, well, don't do that.
Yeah, and he was like, okay. Never do that.
But he was like gearing up for like, okay, I think my life's going to be made significantly worse by the fact that Tucker Carlson's going to target me tonight on his show. And I was like, yeah, you're probably right about that. And so we talked about, he's like, so I'm getting my troops together, like not troops, but his people together, and like, and also security team, because he just, you know, he's just a guy who lives in the Bay Area. He's not like some famous rich guy living up on a shiny hill. So he's like, I gotta get ready. And I was like, all right, whatever you need from me, that's fine. Then it aired, and it turned out it was targeting me.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, hilarious. And then Pastor McBride called me up, like, what do you need, bro? What can you do? I was like, I'll be fine.
Yeah.
And but it did significantly affect my life for about, because he did 2 segments on me.
How did it affect your life?
Like, there was like Twitter blew up, and you're getting more like direct sort of like, you know, like sort of like more frog memes and more, it's more just like direct hate. And I have like my quality filter on Twitter, so I'm sure I'm not getting most of it. And just like when your Twitter blows up and people are coming after you, there's this, and you want to sort of go back after them, but you realize at some point that you can't go back to everybody. And then there was also a side of this that like I was being advised by like people like, don't engage with it at all. Like, just step away from Twitter. Like, because you don't know who's who and what's what, and you don't want to make this, you don't want to make this worse. And so, but it's also like, you know, it also just made me and my wife more paranoid, because we were at that point, where we were living was right in the middle of the open. And it just felt like, you know, we lived in downtown Berkeley, where every night at 3 o'clock in the morning, some crazy guy goes, ah,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
So, and you never know, whoa, is that just a crazy guy, or is that like a, is that like a thing? Is that the announcement of the attack? You know?
Yeah.
And so it just made us, it just made us more paranoid. And then I had gigs on the road, and suddenly we started talking about getting security for the gigs. And I remember I did a gig in Arkansas, I think it was around this time. And I got to the airport, and I was picked up by the police and taken to the gig.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I'd never happened before. And then there was like, I met like 15 cops who were at the gig to like, this one black cop came up to me, and he was like, I really like your work. And I was like, can I ask a question? Do you guys do this all the time, or is this a special case? And he sort of smiled like, ah.
Yeah.
And I was like, got it, special case. You know, so it literally, like, it affected my life in a way that I felt less safe in my world because of what Tucker Carlson did. Because he, you know, he's accusing me of peddling hate, which is, you know, pot calling the kettle Tucker Carlson. Like, that's exactly what his show does, is peddling hate. And then as I talked about it more, I heard from lots of people who aren't blue check mark people with TV shows, who are like, he did that to me, and it did make my life worse, and they didn't have a platform to speak for him about it. So
yeah.
For me, it was like, and at the time I was also like, CNN is also worried about looking like they're at war with Fox News, and so there was also this sort of like, this sort of talk to me about like, don't get into a war with Tucker Carlson. And I was just like, and I remember saying at the time, okay, I accept that, I have to be quiet, I have to sort of sit here and chew it up now, but I'm gonna hold this. Like,
yeah.
I'm a comedian and an only child, so I keep grudges. And so I sort of was like, at some point I'm gonna be able to use this in a way that like actually makes me feel like I can resolve it. And so it gets resolved in this episode of United Shades, when I interview a member of Antifa, and we have a wonderful talk about it.
Did Tucker Carlson invite you on his show
he invited, like, his people called CNN, can we have come out on the show? And they knew that, like, there's no way CNN, even if I wanted to go, there's no way CNN.
They wouldn't, wouldn't.
And I wouldn't. There's no circumstance in which I would do that. I'd rather talk to the Klan again. At least they're honest.
What do you think about the whole debate over whether Democrats should go on Fox News either as guests on shows or you know, obviously they decided not to do any debates there. But I think there's been some debate about that decision
debates,
too.
Debates.
Yeah.
They should have a debate on Fox News. They should have a debate on Fox News about whether or not they should go on Fox News. I don't think Fox News is a legitimate news organization. Maybe I hear Shepard Smith has a good hour. Maybe during that hour it's okay.
Yeah.
But I don't believe as a whole that they are a legitimate news organization, in that they're not putting their, like, every news organization has a bias. I'm not trying to say that like there's unbiased news organizations, but I believe that Fox News, especially the nighttime shows, peddle in lies and misinformation and targeting people and mock and sort of like mocking the weak and mocking the afflicted. So I mean, that's what they do. So I don't know if I was if I was in charge of the Democratic Party, and yes, I will take that job, but it pays a lot.
Yeah.
I think you have to take a stand at some point. Now, they need to take a lot more stands, but I don't know what's the percentage in going on Fox News. Like, what's the best case scenario? Like, the worst case scenario is way more likely than the best case scenario.
Yeah.
But what's the best case scenario?
Yeah, I mean, the idea, I guess, is that there's this whole group of people that they're not going to reach in any other way, and they get more viewers than CNN. Sorry.
Yeah. Don't you apologize to me. I'm not responsible for hate sells.
Yeah.
Misinformation. When you're not adhering to the facts, it's easy to create good programming. You know,
right,
it's
right.
You know, so NBC gets more viewers than that because they make a lot of fictional television.
Yeah.
So Fox News is more of an entertainment channel than they are a news channel, because some people like to be entertained by hate. So I don't. Here's the thing about that: if there was no electoral college, then you maybe go on Fox News because you need to try to get as many votes as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But the electoral college has created a situation through which this is just like a math problem. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not really, it's like, how do we, it's like a strat, it's more of a strategy than a problem than it is like an actual, like, we need to get all the votes possible. So I don't think that, like, I think there's way better ways to get in touch with Republican voters who are likely to vote Democrat, because I don't believe those people are watching Fox News.
Right, right. With that in mind, is there anyone in the field right now that has you excited?
It's straight Thunderdome. I want you all to, like, figure it out and battle it out, and I'll stand outside, like, do that way and see who the winner is.
You have your hometown,
Kamala Harris.
What do you have any thoughts about her? You must have been aware of her maybe longer than most Americans.
That's probably true. I mean, Kamala Harris has a lot of issues in the Bay Area because of her as an attorney general, mm-hmm. the amount how she approached. You know, there's a lot of black men in jail because of Kamala Harris, and in jail for too long because of Kamala Harris. So I think she's got to address the Bay. It's funny. She certainly is a popular figure in the Bay Area. But she's not popular with the most sort of the most progressive people.
Yeah.
So for me, like, I'm not saying that I wouldn't vote for Kamala Harris, I'm not here to stump for anybody right now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I don't know that I will stump for anybody. I really find voting sort of the team sports of politics to be sort of depressing. And I think when it comes right down to it, you have to make that decision for yourself who you vote for. And I really don't want to put myself in a position. And a lot of this is because of my wife too, where I have to explain the sins of another person because I'm their surrogate. I don't want to be anybody's mm-hmm. surrogate. I really find that to be, that's what has kept me out of like really like endorsing anybody a lot of times. Like, because I don't want to have. But what about the time they said I got enough problems explaining things I said. So I mean, certainly. I will, like, if it's Trump versus candidate X, I will go for candidate X. But everybody's got to get better and stronger. And the thing I'm excited about this time is that I believe it's going to be a true primary where the sort of the most tested person comes through it, as opposed to last time where it was really like I said, Bernie didn't take him so seriously until he got into it. And then there's a bunch of people who are so anonymous, we wouldn't recognize them if they walked in this room right now. You know, are you Lincoln Chafee or the other guy? You know, so I think that for me, I'm more interested in the Thunderdome and just sort of like, I want to see you guys get tested and also see people get pulled further to the left who maybe at this point aren't that far, are sort of like the anybody who's running for some moderate position. I'm just like, I have no interest in that I can say 100%. So like for me, it's exciting to think like that, like, because we're so early, like it could be. Maybe it's Joe Biden. You know, like I'm just, mm-hmm. I mean, that Joe Biden.
Yeah.
But it's also so early that it could be Julian Castro.
Yeah, we just don't know.
We just don't know. And I mean, it would be crazy. It can't be Pete Buttigieg. Which I keep trying to.
That's very good.
I just ran through it. But I had to acknowledge it. It could be him. But that would be crazy if it was him. But it was like, it was crazy when it was Obama.
Yeah.
It was crazy when it was Trump. It was crazy when it was Reagan, kids who were old enough to don't remember that.
You can't say that'll never happen.
Yeah, you can't say that'll never happen. So I'm happy to see what happens. But I also think that, like, I hope there's still more people who enter. I hope people get more, because I hope more people enter the race. And I do, the one thing I will say, I'm more excited about newer voices than established voices. I don't like people who I feel like are running for president out of spite.
Mm. So one other thing I wanted to talk about is your late great show, Totally Biased, which I was a big fan of.
You were the one.
So, I mean, it was on, ran for a little more than a year, 2012 to 2013.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you think about that time now, you know, now that you're removed from it a bit, and you have this new show, which has done so well, are there things that you think you would change if you could go back and do it again?
Oh, yeah, I'd change a lot of things.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the thing I would change, which is impossible to change, I would have served a tenure at John Stewart University.
Mm-hmm.
I think the thing that I'm very, like, if you look at the people who are doing well with those kinds of shows right now, many of them are graduates of John Stewart University.
Yeah.
And so for me, I went in there pretty cold. I went to Chris Rock Night School,
mm-hmm.
Which was not, you know, but which was great. But it's just, I think Chris would even agree that, like, if they had said, if FX had said, you have a show, we're going to launch it in a year, but we've gotten you an internship with The Daily Show, I'd have been like, I would have been like, great. Like, I think going back, I needed more experience seeing how that worked up close so that I could have better knowledge of how to make it work for me. So I think I was so green, and that's clear from when you watch. I think it lives better in people's memories than it does if you pull up the clips a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I was very green and learning on the job in a way that, like, you know, John Oliver had to learn how to helm a show. He didn't have to learn how to be on a show, you know. So
right.
I was learning how to be on the show and helm a show. You know, Sam B is the same thing. Trevor Noah even got to spend a little bit of time. Mm-hmm. Simon Oz. Like, there's just all this evidence of people like, oh, that was the way to get there. So, yeah, I would do that differently.
Despite some of the people you just mentioned, I mean, there is still this this major lack of diversity on late night TV, especially on the networks and sort of the bigger shows. And you know, in the time since your show, you know, we saw Larry Wilmore's show get canceled. Mm-hmm. Several female fronted shows, Michelle Wolf, mm-hmm. Robin Thede. You know, is
Arsenio Hall got canceled.
Yeah,
he was another one.
is that disheartening for you to see that kind of stuff? I mean, what do you think's going on?
Robin Thede's disheartening just because I don't know what BET expected to happen with that show. They'd never done a show like that before, so it seems to me you could have just kept it on forever, kind of, because it's going to get better as it goes, and she's going to find her voice. So that one was kind of like, you could just let that show stay on and let it find its way. I think it's proven that remember when Trevor Noah first had this show? I mean, there's still people who haven't taken to Trevor Noah, but he's also found a new audience who's like, didn't watch it before of the streaming.
But he's grown a lot in that role.
He's grown a lot because Comedy Central knew that it was an investment. They weren't going to pull the new host of The Daily Show 3 months in.
Yeah.
Or a year in, even. They were like, this, we have to sort of let this lie. And so they did. And so Trevor Noah got more comfortable. He was already comfortable on TV, but he got more comfortable as the host of The Daily mm-hmm. Show. And like, even now, like, one of the big things that trends on that show is when the between the scenes segments. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's something John Stewart didn't do. So I think giving people, talented people, a chance is how talented people make good things. So Michelle Wolf, you know, didn't have much of a chance because, I mean, you know, it wasn't around long enough for her to get comfortable in it. And if people feel like the minute you make a mistake, you're going to pull them, then they're going to make more mistakes. They're not going to take big chances. So, but I also just think that the reason why I think I wouldn't want to have a show like Totally Biased again is because I hate the fact that there's this thing called late night TV.
Yeah.
That the moment you do one of those, they start comparing you to every other late night TV host. Like when mm-hmm. I had Totally Biased, I'd read articles where it was like the new host in late night TV, and there'd be like a triptych of like me, you know, like Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy Kimmel, David Letterman, you know, like what is that? I'm not doing any of those things. And so for me, I got to think about why Sinak has problem areas. Is that a late night show? I don't think so, but he's sort of doing some of those things, mm-hmm. but it's just on HBO. It's just an HBO show. I think that format of late night show, especially in this era when people don't watch things at the same time, mm-hmm. is in some sense just a tired format to think of. I don't think John Oliver thinks of his show as a late night show. He thinks of it as the John Oliver show. And I think that, like, but again, he's at HBO. You know, I think that, like, when we get, I mean, even Conan is trying to figure out, like, you know,
things up.
Because it's just that format is just like, even the shows that are doing well, the things, it's funny, I mean, people have talked about this, the things that Jimmy Fallon does well are not the things that late night talk show hosts traditionally have done well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's not a long form interview guy. He's not a monologue guy. So I think that format of late night TV is just a tired format. And so I get really sad for people when comics break through and they immediately get them a late night talk show. I'm like, oh no. It's like, for lack of a better idea. And I feel like with Totally Biased, I didn't think of it as a late night talk show, but it was on late night. And so it gets mm-hmm. caught up in that conversation. Like, just put it on at 6 p.m. Like, you know, I think the minute you put it in that box, then people are judging against other things in that box in a way that, like, Atlanta with Donald Glover is just judged as a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, the minute if I was to go, Totally Biased is back, first of all, FX would be like, not so fast, we own all that.
And FXX would be like, I don't think we exist anymore. Exactly.
They don't even have Simpsons reruns anymore, right? They lost that to Disney or something.
I don't know, yeah.
But the minute I would have to be, the exhausting nature of like having to see myself in those articles with like a new late night talk show host.
Yeah.
Just like, it makes me feel sad. But regularly, like, I have Dwayne Kennedy, who is on Totally Biased, also works on United Shades of America, and he's regularly trying to get me to bring it back. Like, he really, it's funny. I was like, when that show was over, you ran out of that building like it was on fire, which a lot of us did. But he was like, I do see things in the news where I'm like, how would I approach this? What's my take on mm-hmm. this? This season with United Shades, I think we have done a lot more stuff with the graphics to sort of push things in a more comedic direction mm-hmm. than we have in the past. So,
and you have stand-up as an outlet for that stuff too,
yeah,
right?
That's the thing. I haven't, this is probably my least year of stand-up comedy since I started doing stand-up just because of other things, but stand-up comedy is my outlet for those things. I mean, the thing I also, late night is so, I remember being frustrated by Totally Biased was that you do those jokes once and never again.
Yeah.
That's such a bummer. the best thing about stand-up comedy is like the first time you do it, it's like, oh, well, this we got 2 years to make this better.
Coming up, W. Kamau Bell tells me why, unlike most comics, he has no problem performing stand-up for politically correct college students. So you've had two stand-up specials on Netflix over the last few years, right?
The first one
was on Showtime. That was Semi-Prominent Negro,
yep,
right?
Yep.
And then you had Private School Negro on Netflix.
Yep, yep.
So is there a third?
The Negro Trilogy?
Yeah, is there a third one coming? Should we expect 2020?
I think I automatically have to make the Negro Trilogy now just because I didn't mean to. But like the first one was called Semi-Prominent Negro because the name that I picked, they didn't like. I don't remember what the name was, but it was like there was all this talk about the name. And so they were saying, well, just pick something from a joke. And I was like, Semi-Prominent Negro. And they were like, oh, that looks good on a graphic.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second one, I'm a big fan of the word Negro. I think it just comes down to that. I just like the word Negro a lot. And I like thinking of myself as a Negro. It's just hard because there's just all these conversations we have to have because racism is just... You know, it's bad right now. We have to have all these people of color. We have to have all these conversations. And unfortunately, we have to have them with white people. It'd be easy if we could just have them with each other. There's racism, right? There sure is. Papa, see you later. And I'm not mad at you, white people. Let me be clear. I'm not mad at you. You're not the ones who are here. You're some of the good ones. You're not like the rest. You speak so well. All I'm trying to say is... I like you, like, hey, that started out as a compliment, but then it hurt my feelings. I know. I learned it from you, Dad. I learned it from you. But yes, I think I'll have to do the Negro Trilogy. But I, like I said, stand-up this year, I've done like two stand-up dates.
Mm-hmm.
I still perform at colleges a lot with my solo show, the W. Kamau Bell Curve, Ending Racism in About an Hour. So I still get like performance out of me. But I also have a 10-month-old baby.
Mm.
So whenever I get bummed out about why am I not doing stand up, I'm like, because you have three kids and one of them is 10 months old. Oh, yeah, that's right.
That's a good excuse for not getting on stage.
It's a great excuse for a lot of things, for not helping friends move. There will be more stand up, but I don't know if it'll even happen in 2020. I don't know when it's going to happen, but I mean, I'll definitely do stand up in 2020.
How do you feel like, your stand-up has evolved over that time from the first special to the second one and now into the future?
I never thought of myself as a person who could tell stories or was interested in telling stories. I really think of, like, stand-up bits as, like, more story forms now. Like, these sort of, like, mm-hmm. these are the short, like sort of punchy bits that are just sort of, like topical bits are usually, like, topical news bits, but, like, all the stuff about my kids are based in stories, and I really like telling long-form stories now. In a way that, like, in some sense, because I do these college dates, I have more time to do that on stage. It's like I have a better time open micing stuff in front of college audiences than I do if I was to go to a comedy club and do like a 10-minute set, you know?
So you like playing at colleges? I've talked to some comics who hate playing at colleges.
I know, this is such a hot topic.
What do you make of that? I mean, you must hear what other people say. Oh, I hate playing colleges. It's just these, you know, woke kids who won't laugh at anything looking around to see who else is laughing. Is that not your experience?
It is my experience, but it's also why college geeks pay more.
Mm.
Like a comedian named Dan St. Paul, who is a great comedian, he does a lot of private gigs. He's like, they don't pay you more at private gigs because you're so great. They pay you more because very few people can do those gigs.
Mm.
So college gigs, I think there was some idea from some comedians and also general that college gigs would be more fun because the audiences are younger and hipper and more, whatever, tuned in. But that's by the nature of college gigs. Any gig that you play where it's a defined Chloe is off community, it's going to be harder. Like, you want to play a wedding reception? you know, like that, like it's, they're all drinking, having a good time. They just saw a wedding. No, you don't want to play a wedding reception. You know, any gig where the audience of people sort of knows each other more than they know you, and they're not walking in as individuals, they're walking in as a group, whether it's even if you play a one-nighter in a small town where everybody in the club kind of knows each other but they don't know the comedian, that's a harder gig.
Mm.
Those just don't pay well as college gigs. But so for me, it's like, first of all, in the history of comedy, most comedians couldn't do college gigs. That's just the nature of the game. And on top of that, colleges are automatically more sensitive areas, even if it's like Oral Roberts University. They're automatically, because they're all there having their brain stretched and also being lectured every day about how to be in the world. And they might have come from some seminar about like how not about consent or some seminar about binge drinking. So they're thinking about all this stuff. And then your job is coming there. And if you're coming in like me, they're bringing me in for a very specific reason. Like, we need a black guy to talk about race. You know, like, but even if you're just a comic who's coming in for comedy night, they're just more sensitive than your average audience because college is not the real world. It's a, it's like a gym for your brain to sort of like expand your mind. And so they're, it's not a regular audience. And so for me, when comedians complain about colleges, don't play them.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, and also, at some point, I'm going to age out of playing them too. Like, at some point, I'm going to not want to, you know, like when it, because this whole, it started with like this thing that like, that Chris Rock, that somebody said Chris Rock said to Seinfeld and Seinfeld, and it was this whole like, well, no, Chris Rock and Seinfeld aren't playing colleges, first of all, because they can't afford to pay them the money that it would cost. And also, they're grown-ass men with kids and mortgages. Like, you know, and I'm one of those too, but I'm still sort of have a thing that now, let me say this. If Chris Rock played at college, he might do great. But there would also be people who are like, wait, I just saw a thing about that thing that Chris Rock said. It's more trouble than it's worth for those guys. Mm-hmm. But colleges are supposed to be more trouble. That's the nature of the game. They're not supposed to be the comedy club is the fun thing. The colleges are not supposed to be the fun thing for the kids. That's work.
And have you had moments in those college gigs where people, you could tell they were upset about something or, walked out?
I can do you one better. Last night, I was in Vegas at the Wynn Casino playing a gig for Mass Torts, the lawyers who take down corporations. Oh. Yeah.
They like comedy, too.
That's what they said they did. They thought they did. So I'm doing the bell curve in a ballroom at the Steve Wynn Casino. Wow. For, I don't know, 500 lawyers, all in suits, all who've been sitting in workshops all day about mass torts. And these are they're the liberal lawyers, but they're also the rich liberal lawyers because they're like taking down major corporations. And it's also like the head of the bar association is there. The Black Lawyers Guild is there. Like, it's all these sort of like we're here to do our thing. And they kind of just wanted to come out to this comedy show and laugh, and I'm talking about structural and institutionalized racism. And I got slides and things and da da da. And I was about 10 minutes in, and it was like not going well.
Yeah.
And I was like, this might be a disaster. Like, this may be one of those gigs where I run out of the room. But the thing that sucks at the casino, I'm staying in the casino. I can't even get to, there's nowhere to run. And
yeah.
I can't figure out how to get out because they're built in circles. But once I had that realization, I sort of talked about it. And by the end, I'd gotten enough of them back that they were happy with it. And I took pictures with them. But for me, it's like, that gig was hard. And in the middle of it, things that normally got huge laughs were getting nothing.
Yeah.
Like, nobody's like, maybe a couple people are recognizing the jokes, but they're also in there with their law offices and teams of people. And like, if I laugh at that, then what does my boss think? Or what does my cohort think? It was nearly a disaster. I pulled it through. Now, some people, I heard that there was a table full of white lawyers who 10 minutes in, at the same point that I went, this could be a disaster, they got up and sort of left in a huff, like in an aggressive huff, like we're going to let people know we're leaving in a huff because we didn't come for this.
Yeah.
We didn't know it was Negroes with Opinions Night. Maybe the name of my next special, Negro with
Opinions.
Oh,
there you go. Yeah.
But the gig paid better than other gigs. You know what I'm saying? And I didn't take the gig just because it paid. It was, I do these gigs all the time. So I'm not saying like it paid enough, so I did it. But it was like they were paying me to do this gig. And I knew going in, like, this is probably not going to be the easiest thing. It's not supposed to be easy all the time. Like, we're literally in comics engaged in one of the hardest art forms, because not only is it like creating art, but it's you're trying to control the reaction of the listener at all times. And that's easier. The easiest place to do that, I think, is a Saturday night at 8 o'clock in a comedy club when people have had a day of rest. They didn't go to work. They've had a couple drinks, but they're not trying to get loaded like the late show. And they're kind of like, we're just here to we're already having fun. We're not at work. We didn't work today. We're just here to laugh. That's the easiest place to do it. The hardest place to do it is any gig where they're flying you in specifically to do a thing that they want you to do. And so for me, when comics complain about those gigs, just don't do them. Like, and at some point, you may find other things to do, but every comic is not promised a career doing colleges. And and if you do them, they're not actually, comics who do those gigs all the time will tell you, they're not fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just going back to United Shades for a moment, is there anything else?
Appreciate that.
Yeah. Is there anything else that is coming up this on this new season that you're excited for people to see, or that might be surprising, or
yeah, we have an episode that's in Jackson, Mississippi, about reproductive justice and reproductive rights, and part of that we film at the last abortion clinic in Mississippi, it's a very, for what it sounds like it could be depressing, but I think it's a super like engaging and up and sort of weirdly uplifting episode. We have an episode about the Hmong people in St. Paul in Minneapolis, which is like this group of Asian people who came, many of them came from Laos. It's all about the secret war. It's a subject I knew nothing about. The secret war is adjacent to the Vietnam War. And so it's an episode that's like, sort of like, one of the things we do is like, here's something that most Americans know nothing about. And so it's one of those. And we have a great episode about, that's in Salt Lake City, and it's about Mormons and the LGBTQ plus community in Salt Lake City, and where they come together and where they don't, and it's trying to be a very sensitive sort of look at the Mormon religion, because it's easy to make fun of the Mormon religion, as we talk about in the episode. Like, they're the one religion you can make fun of and nobody stops you, not even Mormons. Matt and Trey Parker, as we say in the episode, have gotten rich and richer off of making fun of Mormons. So I just said Matt and Trey Parker like they're a couple.
Yeah.
Matt Stone and Trey Parker. But yeah, so that's, and there's a, you know, and we've also got special guests in this season that people who are like, we were able to, like, we've been around for 4 years. So like in that episode, we have Dan Reynolds from Imagine Dragons in it. In the DC episode, we have April Ryan, who's the White House reporter, and we have Henry Rollins in that episode. So we've been able to reach out, and also I bring my friends in, like Pastor Michael McBride is in the megachurch episode. That's a good one about megachurches and money. And then in the Seattle Tacoma episode, my friend Alicia Garza, who's one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter, is in it, which for me is just like, people talk about Black Lives Matter on CNN all the time, and you know, it's sort of a talking point. And just to be able to go, I'm going to put one of the co-founders on the network to speak freely, which very rarely happens.
That's awesome.
About. Yeah.
I mean, these are a lot of dark topics that you cover on the show, or things that can be more depressing in some ways. Have there been ones that you just said, like, I don't know how we're going to make this one funny?
I mean, I say that all the time on the way in. I don't know. But it's like, I find that once you get there and start working with the thing, it's really about people's level of comfortability. So the minute I get there, like with the Hmong episode, what I was told is that it's a very private community. They sort of like don't want to talk to outsiders about what they've been through. So I was nervous, like, how are we going to get anything from these people? Not to just make funny, but just to make a good hour of TV. Mm-hmm. But it's funny, I forget this about myself, as again, I'm a good listener. I'm not going to talk over you. And I think if you approach things as like wide open and just sort of curious, and also I think there's enough evidence of me in the world now that people can look and see that I'm not trying to. I think the sick episode last year did a real good reason, a good way of showing like we can cover a community that I as the watcher, as the host, know nothing about and do it in a sensitive way. So, I mean, yeah, I didn't know that where we would find the humor in that one. And then one of the best things of the season is this man who talks about growing up in the, like, how during the Secret War, his family just escaped to the jungles of Laos, and how as a 7-year-old, he was like climbing trees and would hold onto trees for hours at a time while he was hunting pigeons from trees, and like, you know, having to make his own bow and arrow. And he was hilarious. Like, he just told the story like the way anybody, it's like he told it the way anybody tells a story about when I was a kid, we walked up both hills, walked in snow both ways, uphill both ways. Like, he was very comfortable telling a story. And so his comfortability and his humor around it led me to be comfortable around it. So, you know, I think humor always helps you tell a story better. And it's certainly, people forget that it's a natural human reaction that in the middle of sad things to look for humor. Mm-hmm. It just is. So the show has proven that over and over again. And so in the Salt Lake City episode, there's some really intense stuff about how the Mormon religion, the LDS church, really like pushes people away. And there's like a high suicide rate and all these things. But in there, there's these moments of light that come through that are pretty amazing.
So before we wrap up, what I like to do is kind of go through a few highlights from your career that we didn't get to talk about, and see if you can just pull out one memory or one story that comes, first thing that kind of comes to mind. So to start, can you talk about the first time you got on stage to do stand-up?
It was in Chicago, Illinois, at a place called the No Exit Cafe, and I had to do 5 minutes, and I remember just trying to make sure I did the 5 minutes. Like, that was the big thing. Like, how are you going to be on stage for 5 minutes? There is not one joke from that night that I ever told again after weeks and weeks of writing jokes down in a notebook. And I just, there was literally, and the thing that happened, I came off stage and people go, you have really good stage presence, which I later learned was a way of saying, you didn't have one joke.
So, I didn't laugh, but.
You stood on stage. They were literally saying, you stood on stage for 5 minutes. Good for you. it took me a long time to learn how to write jokes. I would just yammer.
I imagine that a lot of people may have heard you for the first time on This American Life.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn from that experience working with Ira Glass and the This American Life team?
Well, first of all, it's funny. It was one of the first episodes that Ira Glass didn't host himself.
Oh.
So I didn't. He was in the office, and I got to talk to him for a little bit, and mm-hmm. that was nice. But I was like, oh, that's how it works. I come on the guest host week, which was fine. But the thing I learned about that is that everything has a format and a way it's done. So mm-hmm. I learned that week, like, you sort of go, I'm going to do this. And they would be like, but I'm going to. And so when I listen to it, I can hear myself doing a This American Life version of my story, mm-hmm. which at first I was like a little bit bummed out about. But then I realized, no, this is how their listeners need to hear it. So
yeah.
And what the feedback I got was like their listeners reacted to it in a very like sort of strong and positive way, which they probably wouldn't have if I'd been on there. Look here, white people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really proud of the fact that we got that great segment on there with Cliff Means, who did speak very directly to white privilege and what white people weren't doing in a way that I felt like this is not something you hear on This American Life regularly. So I felt like there's stuff in there that was like, I think they've done a lot more race stuff now. I just listened to a piece by Jelani Cobb, but I felt like at that point I was like sort of breaking some ground.
This is something that we talked a little bit about a little while back, but I'm curious to know what sort of the first thing that comes to mind when you think about your trip to Kenya with Anthony Bourdain, which was one of the final episodes of his show that aired.
I mean, the thing that comes to mind is I learned so much in that 11 days with him and his crew that I'm like, looking back, I was like, I would have paid to do that. Like, you know, it's again, mm-hmm. it's that internship thing. If I'd known what I was going to get out of it and they'd said it's going to cost you $10,000 to do this, I'd have been like, mm-hmm. honey, I think we got to do this.
Yeah.
And she would like, let's figure it out. I mean, I learned so much about TV production, about the way they do it versus the way we do it on United Shades of America. And on top of that, I like feel really fortunate that I got that time with him because like he, as people have told me who knew, was like, yeah, he really liked you. Like, we were becoming friends,
mm-hmm.
and not knowing what was going to happen, I'm glad that it very easily could have worked out that I didn't go to Kenya, or that we couldn't figure it out, or he wasn't interested. So that time has become super crystallized in my head. I thought about it a lot because we had a lot of good time. Like, we filmed the show, and then every night after the show, we'd hang out and, mm-hmm. in the hotel restaurant and hang out and just talk. And talked about all sorts of things, him and the crew and me. And so it was like that time is really crystallized in my head because after he passed away, it was just like I really have gone through it a lot. So, yeah, he's one of the greatest.
And the last one I want to touch on, just because it kind of came out of nowhere when I was watching the movie, Sorry to Bother You, your cameo. How did that happen?
That is what I had a good – last year I had a good 20 – the world did not have a good 2018, but I had a good 2018. So I've known Boots for years.
Boots Riley.
He sent me an early screenplay draft of that movie like 6-7 years ago, and I read it like, it's good, but how are you going to pull this off? So, I mean, I literally was like, you know, I don't know how this happens. And so, and I knew him enough to know all the permutations that went through. At one point, he wasn't directing it, and mm-hmm. so then he was directing it. At one point, he was going to star in it, so I got to sort of have a little bit of an insider view of how it all came together. But the funny thing about that is that I was at home one morning. I had a gig that night. I was going to open for The Roots at the Fox Theater in Oakland. And I got a call from my friend Nate O'Green, who was a writer on Totally Biased and who lives in San Francisco. He's like, can you come do a part in Boots' movie? I was like, when? He's like, now. And so I turned to my wife. I was like, can I go do a part in Boots' movie? She knows Boots. He's like, yeah, okay. And so I went down there and didn't know what. We were looking at a fake. It's like a thing where you're not looking at the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
I got to meet Tessa Thompson. I got to meet Steven Yeun, so I got to see some people, got to hang out with some extras. I was there for 2 hours and like said my one line and felt like I don't even know what I'm saying. I don't think of myself as an actor at all. I'm like, God, mm-hmm. I hope I don't ruin Boots' movie, and sort of forgot about it until there started being advanced screenings of it, and people started like saying, "I saw you in the movie," and I was like, "It has given me so much Oakland cred. I'm super excited about it because that is like Oakland's movie right now, and
it really
given
is.
Me so much." I feel like I'm now officially from Oakland because I wasn't Sorry to Bother You.
And finally, we'll end with what's the last thing that made you laugh really hard? Could be something on TV, something in your life, Just anything, first thing that comes to mind that made you laugh.
The last thing that made me laugh really hard. I mean, I laugh all the time, and people talk about my laugh all the time. So I'm a really easy laugh, and I laugh at inappropriate times. I'm trying to think of the last thing that... So my daughters, my two oldest daughters, because I have three daughters now, I have to remember. So my 7-year-old, my 4-year-old, like Queer Eye. Mm-hmm. Like they started, like my 7-year-old started watching it with my wife, Melissa, and then the 4-year-old started watching it, and now they love it, and they watch the same episode over and over again. And there's a scene in Queer Eye from the new season where it's about this guy who's about to have a baby, or his wife's about to have a baby, and his house is a disaster. And they, when they're going through his house, they find a samurai sword, just sort of, like, it's not really a samurai sword, but it was a sword just sort of, mm-hmm. like on the, like this huge, like the kind of thing a dude buys, yeah. just single, that he's gonna, a sword, and it's just sort of sitting in the closet. And in the episode, they make a big deal about how this sword is just hanging out here. And then later, Juno is like, she will recap the episodes, mm-hmm. and she was like, and there was a samurai sword just chilling out in the room. And just a 4-year-old saying just samurai sword and just chilling in one sentence.
Yeah.
It just made me laugh until I cried. Because it was just like the way she said it, like she couldn't believe it, even though you don't even know what a samurai sword is.
Yeah.
You didn't, what is just, he didn't say chilling. Where are you getting the word chilling from? We don't say chilling like that. We haven't, you know. And there's a samurai sword just chilling. And she was so confused about why it was just chilling. And it just made me laugh and laugh and laugh. My kids make me laugh a lot. Yeah. And they know they make me laugh, so they try to make me laugh.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for coming and doing the show today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you so much to W. Kamau Bell for making the trek down to L.A. to be on today's show. You can watch United Shades of America every Sunday night at 10 p.m. Eastern on CNN and find his tour dates at wkamaubell.com. And we'll put a link to buy his book, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell, in the description for this podcast as well. If you enjoy the show, please tell your friends and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. The Last Laugh is distributed by Himalaya Media for The Daily Beast. It is produced by Jason Smith for Starburns Audio and Scott Porch for Himalaya Media. And this episode was engineered and edited by Mackenzie Mazzell. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week!